Thank you. And thank you very much for asking me. And I should say that diabology and the esoteric side of the conversation is not something on which I claim any expertise. I'm not sure I used to really believe in evil. I always used to find it extremely difficult. I had a very religious personal upbringing. I used to go as a child to church every Sunday, sometimes twice every Sunday. I was in the choir. I was a crucifer. I used to carry the cross about in procession. One of the things I could never quite get my head round was the idea of hell and that people could be so bad that they would deserve eternal punishment. And that's partly because I couldn't really understand the notion of evil, what evil was, how people connected to it. But I can't pretend to have spent a great deal of my life thinking about theology, and I can't pretend it had a great effect on my everyday life. I want to talk a bit about the start, about not what's happening in the world now, but about the first Gulf War, and my experiences when I was an ambassador. And in particular, there are two things I want to focus on, and that's the fact that people in the Foreign and Commonwealth Office where I worked knew, everyone knew, everyone with any professional interest in the subject knew that there were no Iraqi WMD. There's no doubt we knew that. By chance, a few years earlier, I'd been head of the FCO section of the Embargo Surveillance Center, the job of which was to monitor Iraqi weapons procurement and make sure Iraq didn't get any weapons. And we knew very well what Iraq had and didn't have, and we knew Iraq had no WMD. That experience was a few years past by 2001. But I still knew enough to know there were no Iraqi WMD still in 2001. And when the what became famous as the Dodgy Dossier was published, I happened to be that morning just walking down a corridor. I was actually on Russian language training. I happened to be just walking down the corridor in our Middle Eastern department or Near Eastern North African department, it's called, and I saw Bill Patey, who was the head of department, and Bill also is ex-Dundee University. So I stopped him. I said, "Bill, what's this dossier? It's all nonsense, isn't it?" And he was the head of the department at the time. He's one of the people who signed off the dossier. And I said to him, "Bill, I mean, it can't be right. It can't be true." And he just laughed and said, "No, of course not, Craig. It's all bollocks." And continued on down the corridor. But he'd signed it. But I just skipped that. And the point of what I'm saying is actually Bill is one of the nicest people you could meet. He's a lovely man. He's a really, really nice person. He went on to become British ambassador to Iraq and British ambassador to Afghanistan at the time when we were occupying those countries and killing people. The result of his insouciance, not just his, but the collective insouciance of all the people who worked in that organization was that nobody will ever know exactly, but probably there were at least 1 million consequent deaths from launching that war. But the people who did it were my friends. They were my work colleagues. I'd worked there for over 20 years. I knew all these people. I used to drink with them. They were the Foreign Office is a very strange place to work, of course, because you're dealing with a lot of top secret material you can't talk to anyone else about. So that obviously creates a certain camaraderie, and you're part of a corps which is viewed as the elite, and that creates a camaraderie. And you get posted off to places all around the world and live in small isolated communities, and that causes a camaraderie. So It's a place with very much a team spirit, and I was absolutely a part of that team. I was a valued and highly thought of and liked part of that team. I wasn't an outsider. And this was my milieu. These were the people I spent my life with. And they weren't apparently evil people. They were nice people, but they were going along with something which was going to lead to war and death, and war motivated by, as they probably would admit to you, war motivated by greed, by the desire to acquire hydrocarbons, by the desire for money, by various people who were directing the policy. They weren't the ones directing the policy. They weren't particularly making money out of it, but they were prepared to go along with what can only be evil. You're doing something that's based on something you know is a lie, and a million people are going to die as a result. That's evil. And I said that was the first thing I was going to say. And the second thing, and before I come off that, I'll just say I did ask a friend subsequently. I asked him how he'd rationalized it. And I still have friends today in the forums. My contemporaries are all retiring now, but obviously I knew younger people who worked for me and things, and they're still in the Foreign Office. I do still talk to people there. But this wasn't long after. This was only 2 or 3 years after. I spoke to someone still in the Foreign Office, and I asked him how did he rationalize it? I said to him, "You knew there were no WMD." And he this person and I, we both used to play the video game Football Manager. And he said, when we're playing Football Manager, for 3 hours I'm playing, I am the manager of Manchester United. That's who I am. I'm in my head, that's the world I'm inhabiting, that's what I'm living in. He said, when I go into the Foreign Office, there are Iraqi WMD. They exist. He said, "No, if you ask me in real life outside, do I know I'm not the manager of Manchester United? Of course I do. And if you ask me outside the Foreign Office, and you're a friend from the Foreign Office, and say to me, do I know there are no Iraqi WMD? I will say, of course I know that. But while I'm in the office, and again, this is not an evil person. This is a really nice human being who's kind and considerate to his neighbours, who gives to charity, who loves his children, all those metrics of what makes a nice person. And yet he's thinking it's like a video game when you're doing things that are going to result in huge numbers of deaths. And exactly the second thing I was going to talk of, which is exactly the same thing really, was when I blew the whistle on torture and extraordinary rendition, because this was happening all around the globe. And British ambassadors all over the place, scores of them, must have been involved in the CIA exercises that were kidnapping people and taking them off to be tortured. I was a bit at the sharp end because people were actually being sent from all around the world to Uzbekistan in order to be tortured. But one way or another, lots and lots of British diplomats were involved in it. And when I tried to stop it internally by sending top secret telegram saying this is happening, we should stop it, this is bad, this is immoral, it's illegal, it's not practical, all the arguments I could come up with, I was copying in lots of other embassies around the world into those telegrams I was sending back to the Secretary of State in London. And I was receiving all kinds of private messages from my fellow ambassadors, congratulating me and saying, "That's great. I'm really glad. Stick it to them. You stick up for it." Nobody would go on the record in public. I don't mean in public, but I mean officially in the official channels I was using, no one would support me. But they sent me private messages of support. And this includes people who went on to become really quite well known publicly, like Christopher Meyer and Jeremy Greenstock, who were both ambassadors to the UN at different times. And both ambassador, well, Jeremy was ambassador to Iraq at some stage.
Kevin Rudd, one of Australia's foremost political figures who I hold in very high regard. How do you see him?
I'm not catching the name.
Kevin Rudd.
Oh, Kevin Rudd. Oh, yes. No, Kevin, I think seems to be a decent person as far as I can tell. But I can't pretend I know him well. And I can't pretend I had, I'm not particularly aware of where his positioning was at that time, but that might just be my memory, which is slipping. But again, it's not just they must have known about it. Things were happening in their embassies that facilitated it, that facilitated mass torture. And all these people who were decent people were doing nothing to stop it. And they knew it was wrong. They knew it was wrong. But they still went ahead with it. And that's something I've struggled with this ever since. I've struggled to get my head round it. When I used to go, and this is all a long while ago, so it's a long while since it's been the principal thing I discuss. But when I used to give talks on the subject regularly, I'd always be asked why had I gone public and why had I resigned? And I always used to reply, well, I saw no alternative course of action. But the question I don't understand is why nobody else went public and why nobody else resigned. And that's partly to do with the system dragging you in, I suppose. And it's partly to do with the fact that it does seem, unfortunately, that most people do value their job and their career and their security and their children's private education or their status or whatever it is that they're hanging on to. They do value that other than taking any kind of moral stand. But I think the
Therefore, the focus of history is on, but the implications absolutely.
the ease with which people can become co-opted to evil, because I think they were co-opted to evil. I more clearly see that now. The ease to which people are co-opted, with which people are co-opted to evil, is a very, very difficult question. And now, of course, what we're seeing is the atmosphere of diplomatic nicety and of pretense which surrounded international relations back 20 years ago, 25 years ago, even when millions of people were being killed in a desire to grab Iraq's oil. Now there's not felt to be a need to make that pretense anymore. The current attack on Iran, there's very little pretense at all that it's motivated by anything other than an attempt to manipulate the world's oil markets to grab Iran's oil if possible. And if that's not possible, to engineer a situation in which fortunes can be made on the oil market. And that this comes immediately after the genocide in Gaza, which nobody in power had any interest in stopping. And one thing that's very, very plain to me is that it illustrates that Western democracy is an utter sham. Because I never thought, for example, I never ever thought we would see a situation where a majority of people in the United States actually tend more to support the Palestinians than support the Israelis in opinion polls that ask that question in various formats. But we are in that situation. And we're in a situation where the majority of people in almost every Western country, except for Germany, why Germany is so utterly weird, is an interesting question. It's something much deeper than Holocaust guilt. It's a tendency to genocide. Why, other than Germany, in every other Western country, people were horrified by what was happening in Gaza and horrified by what their own governments were doing. But nobody had any ability to prevent it. There are no levers of power which the population, even when the population is pretty well united in detesting something, the population cannot stop it. We now have a situation where in almost every Western government you can name, in France, in Germany, in the United Kingdom, in Sweden, and in the United States, the government in power has historically low approval levels. In all of those countries at the moment, if you ask them how many people approve of their government, you'll get 15% within 2 or 3% in all those countries will say they approve of their government. And that's not a net figure. That's the number who approve. The number who disapprove is something like 60. The net figure is something like minus 45. And those are absolute record figures. The utter discontent and disconnection of people from what their governments are doing is extreme. And there's a great understanding that the people in power, the so-called elite, don't represent us. The Epstein files, I know you've been discussing, and they open up questions which I've often asked. I'd noticed, because, you know, I used to be an ambassador. I spent a lot of time in various ways dealing with extremely powerful people. That extremely powerful people are much more likely than other people to enjoy the act of humiliating and degrading other people, even in everyday work situations, you know, to be just really nasty and unpleasant. And so one question I've always wondered is, why is it, for example, that there seems this very plain extra prevalence of paedophilia among the very powerful than among the general population? These are extraordinary things, and these are signs. I think that we have a society in which a devotion to evil, in which a psychopathic attitude is what gets you power. And perhaps that's a problem with the notion of power. Perhaps power itself is evil. Anyway, I think those are the reflections I'd like to give to you. I'm not quite sure that's how you expected me to talk. And these are deeply personal things that I grapple with and fail to understand. I don't actually think there is a simple mechanistic explanation that revolves around secret committees and things. I don't deny the existence of organized groups and committees, some of which are secret, but I don't think that there is a mechanistic explanation for the workings of human evil. I don't think that you can find an institutional explanation for why it is that the leaders of states, not just the leaders as a person, but the leadership cadres of powerful states were happy to see Palestinian children massacred, killed, die the most horrible deaths of maiming and pain and extreme agony, see that happen to children and not feel there was any interest in intervening. I don't think there can be an institutional explanation to any of that. I think it comes to something deep-rooted in the human psyche, which is going to out whatever the institutions of power. The only question is what we can do to regulate our societies better to prevent it. Anyway,
yeah,
thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Craig. That was very powerful, and you raised lots of important issues. I mean, the old to Henry Wotton quote about diplomats, people sent abroad to lie for their country. I mean, in your case, you refused to lie, and thank you, credit from the British people here for that courage. And you're right. Why didn't more? Why aren't they now? Why aren't people now complaining about the Iran issue and the fact that we're letting, you know, British bases be used for the bombing runs and stuff? We did discuss the question of why and where evil comes from in the earlier bit. You've not gone back to theology for possible explanations, I take it. Maybe when you've heard our earlier discussions, you might want to get out some of the texts. But any brief questions now to Craig, and then we're going to move on and hear from our next speakers in this panel. But very important points he's raised.
If I can just come in and comment, it's a pity Tony has disappeared, our journalist commentator, because he's done a lot of research on Bilderbergers, evil, etc. However, just to make a quick point, Craig, hopefully this has been recorded and will be video edited and uploaded. Yeah, the other files.
Yes,
I will
of course.
Make sure.
They can all watch everything.
Yeah. So back to you, Thomas, again.
Yeah, well, we're coming to James as our next speaker, in fact. So if you hold that thought, is there anyone else would like to, you've got a chance to ask Craig any other questions before we move on to James. It's a lot we've you know, listened to. I mean, I have a question about the institutionalization of lying and the lack of whistleblowing structures. I think we face a constitutional problem in democracies. I still believe in democracy, but I think we do have to build in like a whistleblowing structure at the highest level. So if people are being blackmailed, and I think that explains a lot of the silencing, Craig, I think if there is compromise on a lot of people in power, there needs to be somewhere they can go, somewhere neutral, outside the party political system. Like in Britain, it could be a sort of branch of the Privy Council or something, where you say, look, I'm being blackmailed by country X or Y. That's what they need in America. Trump, people like Trump need to be able to go and say, look, I can't stop bombing Iran because X, Y, Z. Has there any been discussions like that that you know of, say in the Foreign Office or elsewhere? And why don't we have that?
Well, I think you'll find, certainly the Foreign Office, and I think probably most governmental institutions do have official whistleblowing policies, but they just don't stick to them. And whistleblowing will always be characterized as something else, particularly if it relates to national security. And of course, the motives of the whistleblower will always be impugned. I mean, in my case, even before I went public, they started this massive attack on me and the tabloids about my sex life and drinking and all kinds of things. 99% of which wasn't true. There was a core truth in it. I've never claimed to be a saint, but certainly all the illegal or unpleasant aspects of it were untrue. And they always will go on the offensive against whistleblowers, I'm afraid. Whistleblower protections certainly do exist in theory, but I don't think anywhere the establishment really means it.
Thank you so much for this insight into this level of the decision making. It's something I have also experienced being married to a diplomat and meeting a lot of these high level diplomats all the time, discussing the Palestinian and the regional policies of the Western democratic, between brackets, government. And I was surprised, shocked even, that many of them, to escape from facing the reality, the truth, they would start to blame the Palestinians for that. This is the discourse. And I felt it, I have seen it all along, all the diplomatic, regardless their country of origin, regardless where they come from, they always use the same narrative. And I had the impression they all receive one courier, that is distributed to all these ambassadors to tell them exactly how they should respond. And I was so shocked. I'm wondering if this is the case. This is how they usually distribute the position, how to reply to this kind of questions and this kind of debate. Because, of course, it doesn't make sense. Of course, most of the time they would escape by silence or by starting even to intensify their attacks by becoming even more towards me as a Palestinian. They would become more aggressive. more completely in a denial mode. And I'm wondering, is there any central level where they distribute to all these ambassadors across Europe or even some other Western countries, or to say exactly
Sure.
the same?
I mean, you would get from your own government indications of what you were expected to say, but primarily they weren't in the format of talking points or points made. It's quite simply that what you're expected to is repeat what ministers say. If your minister has said something, you can't say something different if you're an ambassador. So you would carefully study replies to parliamentary questions, ministerial speeches, those kind of even ministerial television interviews, and make sure that whatever you said was in line with what the minister said. And that's actually your job as an ambassador. But that would work that way. And you were, that's one of the things you would do all day, sit there reading up anything that had been said by your Home Office. And the difficulty is, of course, that at the ministerial level, that's where directions are being taken through, IPAC, through BICOM, through all kinds of particularly on the subject of Israel, through the Israel lobby has great influence over ministers all over the world, and so that's where the direction comes in. It doesn't come into the diplomatic corps; it comes into the political bosses. And then all the diplomatic corps can do is reflect whatever the political bosses are saying. But no, I mean, it's quite astonishing. I think the gulf between political messaging and truth is one of the things which is just so obvious in the current situation. And in particular, all the blaming of Iran for the situation in the gulf without ever being mentioned by politicians, that Iran was illegally attacked. It's quite extraordinary that they had, what was it, 40 odd nations having a virtual meeting convened by the UK on the subject of the opening of the Gulf of Hormuz. And at no stage did any one of those 40 nations point out that it was Iran which was attacked, which was the cause of this war. I still do have friends in the Foreign Office who used to work for me or whatever. So I do know that.